The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
This is the second time I have preached a Memorial Day sermon from this pulpit. Once again, it feels strange to tackle as serious and tragic a subject as war on what is for most of us a welcome extended weekend to enjoy with our families and friends, a time when the weather is usually pleasant enough to enjoy outdoor activities. The school year is almost over, and many of us are looking forward to summer's often more leisurely pace. This year, our church holds a family retreat on this weekend, which many members of our congregation are presently at, where we get to enjoy nature in a beautiful setting, play music and games together, hang out with our children, even become, for a moment, like kids ourselves again. Do we really want to be reminded that the people we are supposed to remember on Memorial Day are the soldiers who died in our nation's wars? Even if they died for a commendable cause, like the Northern soldiers who fought to end slavery in the Civil War, the subjects of the original Memorial Day, their deaths are still a reminder of our own mortality and of the risks we might have to take to live our values with courage and integrity. And when you consider that most wars the U.S. have fought have had nothing to do with liberating anyone from bondage or exploitation, these thoughts are even more sobering. A few people in this room are old enough to have been children during World War II, or war where many enlisted to fight fascism, an honorable cause, one which, of course, is unfortunately back on the agenda and may force us soon to make tough choices about what we are willing to do to defeat it. Still, fighting fascism was not the main reason the U.S. entered the war. In our current capitalist and imperialist system, which dominates the world's economy, the purpose of war is to gain more power and profit for a few. And those few do not risk their own or their children's lives in battle. No, they risk the lives of other people's children, especially those whose economic prospects they limit, often by racism as well as by poverty and precarity. They either conscript them by force, or as in the U.S. today, by offering false promises of adventure, education, and upward mobility, should they sign up to be soldiers. Yes, we should remember and mourn the deaths of these soldiers. And we absolutely should demand that all living veterans receive the care they are owed by a government who put them in harm's way. And we should support their healing from moral and physical injury. Yet we can't, in good conscience, honor what they were actually fighting for. Now more than ever, as we face absolute ecological limits, this system, which depends on expanding of markets, must destroy what has already been built and ruthlessly battle competitors to find room to expand again. It seduces us with racism, nationalism, and twisted versions of religious belief, dehumanizing the vast majority of the world's peoples, all to ensure that we remain pawns on a giant chessboard to be sacrificed as needed to put their competitors in check. Our politicians are willing to invest a trillion dollars of our taxes annually into this game. Meanwhile, funding for healthcare, housing, education, and environmental protections, what we really need, is being slashed with no mercy, and the war budget remains sacrosanct, even for those who oppose the cuts. There is no net value given to us in return for this deadly investment. And if there were, it would only be off the destruction of other people and the earth itself. At best, war may be a self-defensive necessity to liberate the oppressed when all other means have failed. If victorious, however, liberators risk becoming the next generation of warmongers and dictators if they glorify the means used to win rather than soberly mourning the losses it took. A lasting peace requires building societies grounded in equity, freedom, democracy, and the sustainable use of resources to benefit all. To build, we must eschew the means to destroy. War for greed, though, is unforgivable. It is absolutely antithetical to Unitarian Universalist values. It leads only to the destruction of all we hold dear, even ultimately to the annihilation of humanity and probably most other life on this planet. Nothing we gain can last if power remains in the hands of those so greedy that they would risk everything just to become more obscenely rich and powerful. Opposing such war is necessary for our survival. So, why isn't opposing war at the very top of our priorities? I would posit that the inevitability of war is so ingrained in our consciousness that we seldom try to imagine a world without it. The problem of war is so big, ending it feels so impossible. Why bother? For millennia, prophetic voices have preached the value of peace. All the world's major religions claim peace as a virtue. Christianity, for example, cites Jesus as the Prince of Peace. Yet, still war persists. We long for a day when children are not starved and blown into pieces as they are in Gaza right now. And wherever the conflict is, on either side or more sides, no parent should ever have to bury a child killed in war. Yet war still persists. Even though many of us find fictional violence to be entertaining, I admit to the guilty pleasure of enjoying many TV shows that depict violence, very few people enjoy it in real life. Most of us would feel genuine remorse if we lost control in a moment of rage and physically hurt someone. Unless convinced by propaganda that they are not fighting fully human persons, even most soldiers in the thick of battle have no real desire to kill. They are often traumatized for life if they know they have taken the lives of others. Yet, still war persists. That's not hard to imagine why. First, biologically, we evolved as predators and omnivores. Killing to eat and to defend ourselves was how we survived. It's kind of hardwired. As I heard UU minister Reverend Jennifer Kwong once say, all life is based on murder. That is, nothing can live without destroying other life. Even vegetarians kill plants. Second, though the stated justifications from war may vary greatly, at its root, war is almost always a battle for resources. probably initially for the survival of small tribes competing for truly scarce necessities, but increasingly throughout history to enrich powerful elites. There are basically two roles in any war. Offensive forces initiate violence to expand their territorial control over resources, and defensive forces resist in kind. Defensive combatants mostly fight to survive and to keep whatever they have, even if they have nothing to gain otherwise. Offensive combatants mostly fight because they have been coerced or riled up by various forms of propaganda. The resources won or kept, scarce or not, remain controlled by those in power. Thus, in early human history, war might have been a rational, albeit brutal, group survival strategy. But modern war offers little to the actual fighters. Only wars of liberation, grounded in self-defense even when tactically offensive, can potentially offer benefits to non-elites, though at the cost of great sacrifice and morally troubling collateral damage. Plus, as I noted earlier, gains can be lost easily, such as when internal competition over scarce resources erupts, or battle readiness must be maintained against outside threats. As you can probably tell, I am not a pacifist, and I have physically defended myself against lethal force. And even at my age, I hope I will have the courage and ability to unite with others to resist fascism physically if we fail to defeat it through other means. And yet, though we may be hardwired to consider violence when we perceive it to be necessary, we have also evolved to have free will and to view our choices through a moral lens. As persistent as war is, if we can imagine peace, that is, imagine a time when the lives of all people are held sacred, never violated by state-sanctioned violence, we can continue working toward peace. As Sam said in his reflection, if you can't imagine it, what chance do you have of actually doing it? Especially when the problems are so big that any rational person would say it was impossible to solve. Long ago, I also took a class. In this one, each student was assigned to create a, quote, impossible promise to guide their life's work. A promise so big, it would be impossible without engaging millions of people. Even more daunting, we had to set an achievement date within our potential lifespans. Here was mine, quote, by the year 2040, I promise a world where all people have the material and spiritual resources to live fulfilled lives and the power to choose lives they love. Whew. Achieving world peace is a necessary foundation for that promise. Can peace be achieved by 2040? Before you say no, consider this. Given the existential crises we face today, if we are not actively engaged now, 15 years before 2040, it may be too late to ever achieve peace. So imagine, yes, imagine that peace is possible, so that we engage ourselves now and others to make it a reality. Thank you.
Junior year of college, I take a class on social entrepreneurship because some of my friends said good things about it. Social entrepreneurship is basically starting a business, but with a for good mission, or maybe a nonprofit that still manages to make some revenue. The class was great. The professor described it as being like business school compressed into one term and with a focus on nonprofits, and it didn't disappoint. I liked the class so much that I decided to take the next one. Only this class wasn't just learning, it was actually putting your skills to use and starting something. I didn't really know what I was gonna do, but I was running a tech for a good club and I thought it could be something more. So I made that my project. I came up with a logo, a name, a business plan, got a group of friends to help me with it. We started reaching out to other schools to get new chapters of the organization set up. The nonprofit never really took off, but it still set me on the path to be working in tech for good full time. Without that class, I might just be working at a generic big tech company. There was a ton of other wisdom in that class that I've tried to carry with me. A common theme was not to put yourself in a box, not to limit yourself, to instead take the uncomfortable step that might get you somewhere. Cold emailing people, putting yourself out there, asking for what you need. After all, as the professor would say, if you don't ask, they can't tell you yes. I think the reason my professor encouraged us to get out of our comfort zones and do big things is because if you want to solve big problems in the world, you can't do that when being comfortable. You can't do that without putting yourself out there and hearing no a lot. But still staying convinced that your idea was good so you can keep bringing others on board. One part of nonprofit business planning that we learned about was called the BHAG, an acronym for the Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal. That means if everything goes well, what change could you make in the world 10 years from now? How many lives could you save? What policies could you get into place? Who could you help feel safe in their own skin, in their own community? What part of the interconnected web of existence could you help repair? Whose inherent worth and dignity would finally be recognized without question? And that's important. It's important to ask big questions, to imagine that you can make the world a better place in a big way. Because if you can't imagine it, then what chance do you have of actually doing it? Especially when the problems are so big that any rational person would say, it was impossible to solve, it's unrealistic, you should just quit. Since then, I've continued to try to make the world a better place with my career, doing some work in healthcare, government, politics. I haven't always succeeded, but I have done some good. And there's a good chance that the reason for a lot of that good was because 15 years ago, one of my teachers told me to imagine that I could do something big.